was completed by taking a full schedule while working full time. I worked for the Department of Public Assistance. At that time, we were on the tail end of the Depression, and I worked for them for a little over a year and took 9 credits each semester at night and 6 in the summer, got my year and graduated in 1939, and then continued going part-time while I was working. I wanted to originally get into social work. That was a settlement influence. But the new School of Social Work at Pitt, which had just started, would not take part-time students, and I couldn't afford to go full-time. So that eventually went by the board. I then worked for a year as running a recreation center for the city of Pittsburgh. That was an afternoon and evening job, which allowed me to go to college in the morning. And then in March of 19, and I took every single civil service exam I could. You've got to realize that opportunities were few because of the Depression, and even fewer for Jews at that time. The percentage of Jews that you found in government was enormous, simply because that was the only way to go. If you went into a liquor store, the majority of clerks were Jews. If you went into a government office, they were Jews, all over, because the government did not discriminate. So I had taken a number of exams. I was kind of a protege of Genevieve Blatt, who's now on the State Commonwealth Court, and just retired. She was head of the Pittsburgh Civil Service Commission. She used to tell me about these exams and so forth. But anyway, in March 1941, I was offered and accepted the job that I kept for 33 years, and that was with the U.S. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. That was, to my mind, a perfect job because it was in the labor area. Now, at that time, I started to date more than before. I had a car, it was my first car. It's part of the essential. Then you could date people who were not from your neighborhood. That was another problem, too, that if people were from your neighborhood, it was your sister. You didn't date your sisters. You know, that's everybody. So that I think the car had something to do with it. Having some money was important. I went to Erie on that job, and from that went into the service in August of 82.
42.
Into the service.
42.
While I was in camp in Alabama, I was part of, because of my background, I was part of the classification team that interviewed new recruits coming into camp for purposes of training and assignment. I got a call one day from someone whom I had interviewed 2 months before, called from New York. He told me his wife was coming in and wondered if I could help him because he couldn't get a pass to even go to the railroad station. I met her, pretended she was my wife so I could get her through into camp to see her husband. I used one of the lines current at that time, which was, any more like you where you came from? She said yes, and she told me about this club member. She was a club leader in New York, whom I eventually met and eventually married. She's here in town. She's Vivian Richmond, and she's now, I think, head of the education department of Chapman. We were married for 18 years. We have 2 children, both of whom are on the West Coast. One, Rachel, is in Berkeley. She is now press secretary for a member of the California State House. And Jessica, who is in Portland, Oregon, and she's a city planner there.
You mentioned that the job that you took was the job you stayed with.
For 33 years, yes.
Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, it was kind of a dream, because keep in mind I had this labor background. To understand the labor background, I can note parenthetically that my father was a member of the Cigar Makers Union in Pittsburgh. That was the period that we skipped over in between. And Samuel Gompers was the head of the Cigar Makers Union, and then from it founded the American Federation of Labor. And according to my father, Samuel Gompers would stay at our house when he would come. So the roots go way, way back. And it was always a labor-minded house. And there was always this consciousness of it. So that when I had this opportunity to go with the U.S. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division, this was heaven. And I was very pleased and enjoyed my work. It involved enforcement of the minimum wage law, now 335. At that time, it was 25 cents an hour. Time and a half over 40, well, for a while it was 44, then 42, then 40 hours a week. So that it was very satisfying, most especially in the earlier days, because you were fighting the sweatshops, you see. So here, it was familiar territory. Not only that, I was assigned to Erie when I started, and I went to work under a man named John B. McCutcheon, who was a kind of a legend because he came over from Scotland when he was 12 years old, was self-taught, could recite every word that Bobby Burns had ever written, and had been a coal miner, worked in the mines for years, and educated himself right along. And he had a very strong sense of purpose in enforcing legislation like this. And we had some miserable working conditions the upper end of Pennsylvania. There was a booming furniture town named called Warren, which was just south of Jamestown. Jamestown furniture was a big deal then. And they had these factories because we had hardwoods in northern Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, we decimated the forests and the factories went. But it was commonplace to go into a furniture factory in Warren and force employers to bring people up to 25 cents an hour who were married people raising kids and who were minus a number of fingers because of industrial accidents. That was taken as a matter of course. I was threatened, I was followed, I was chased out of factories, but that was all very exciting with it for a young person with a message and a cause. And I stayed with them right along. Now I went back to school and got my master's on my GI Bill after I came out of service. Well, I was married just before I came out of service in 46. And soon after that, started taking courses on the GI Bill and got my master's in 54. I continued at Pitt part-time teaching there. In fact, I've been teaching part-time since 54. Taught in the School of Business at Pitt. This was all part-time. Then I taught for Penn State in their extension courses. And then my most recent experience, 1974, I was back at Pitt at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, all in the labor relations field. I retired in 74, and at that time took a job with the state of Pennsylvania as a labor mediator. So it was a companion field. But here I'm the neutral. One of the little stories that came out of this place was that I gave a talk on labor relations to the Russian immigrants here in this building. And I gave it in Yiddish. They hadn't spoken that loud for a long time. And the Russians couldn't understand it because they look upon a strike as counter-revolution. They don't know about unions. And after a long time, one of them finally said, aha, du bist ein Scholemacher. You're a peacemaker. Which is, I hope I wasn't too much of a
fan. No, I think it's fine. All right, you're married, you've got your first job, you're setting up housekeeping, you're raising your family.
Well, let's I already had the job before I was married.
Right. Yeah. Okay, then you've got married, you continued in your work, you set up housekeeping, you raised your children. Let's talk about those things.
Well, initially, because I was fresh out of the Army, And one of the advantages in getting married just before you come out of the Army is nobody has to buy a formal. You're in it. So I knew I was about to be discharged. At that time, I was stationed at Camp Edwards, Massachusetts, which made it easy for me to go to New York for my courtship. There, because she lived in the Bronx, and we would meet when we got there. So I'd get down there almost every weekend. Now, when we came here, we just had a room on Beacon Street, a kind of a basement room next to where Hillel is, you know, those houses that are set back a little way. And this was with some people that I had met when I was home on a furlough. We would eat all our meals out. We were both working. We ate at a place called the Little Hungarian Restaurant. Remember? That's upstairs from where Giant Eagle is now, on corner of Bartlett Street. It was then Pearl Richmond. And we would be there. My wife worked for the Veterans Administration. I was working for the Department of Labor. Eventually, she worked with the state, and then she left, and then the children came along. I think the first came when we'd been married, I think about 7 years, and this was Rachel. By that time, we had bought a house on Jackson Street next to Highland Park, and reflecting the frugality of the prior time, I insisted upon a short mortgage to be paid off as quickly as possible. Because one of the constant fears on the Hill was that you would lose your house. They had something then called a building and loan. They went out of existence. And I remember how everything else was sacrificed, probably including meals, so that you made that payment. And it's burned into my mind because I know it was every other Tuesday night. I had to walk down to Fifth Avenue, and I remember the building, it's still there, it's now some sort of a wholesale house. And you had to pay that, the fear of losing the house, and the great pride when you eventually owned it. This was something unthinkable, but this came out of even the European experience, you see. And some of the good and the bad things, the trauma, still live on. And you find people who maybe can afford certain things and won't spend them. That earlier fear. Our kids have a great advantage. In fact, they go the other way. They don't have it, they spend it. So that affects us. And sometimes you look back on something you have bypassed almost with shame because you were afraid. And you no longer have that kind of fear, but it's there. So some of the values are good and some of the fears are bad. With the Department of Labor, I eventually became the director in Pittsburgh in 1964, and being over the staff. During that time, I would frequently go down to Washington to help develop regulations, policies, enforcement procedures, and so forth. I had opportunities to go to Washington with promotion. Turned them down simply because my roots are very strong in Pittsburgh. Even today, I would not think of retiring somewhere else. Having always been kind of out in the public, that is, whether in swimming activities or I was a debater for Pitt and also for the schools and activities in the Jewish community. Just know a lot of people, and that's part of your security blanket.
Did you find raising children then different than you see raising children today?
A little bit, yes. I think you've got to realize that what was occurring during the time that my kids were growing was that you had the feminist movement. The change in role relationship of husband and wife and its effect upon the kids. I was married to a very, very capable woman. My dad one of the only men that ever marched in the suffragette parade. So that intellectually, there was no question about it, that I was prepared to live with a capable career woman on a career basis. Someone else will have to judge as to whether or not I was emotionally prepared. You know, sometimes there's a difference. So that I had a very active wife who was very active primarily in folk music. She worked with the Tamaritzans and so forth. Out of the house a great deal. And meanwhile, we were raising kids. Well, when I reached a certain point, you could go along with these activities. See. But I think reflecting the early awkwardness of the feminist movement, and thank God the younger women are very natural about it, sometimes there were adjustments that were a lot more difficult between husband and wife. Their roles, who was to be responsible for what, relationship with the kids, a household, outside activities. And I think that might have been one of the factors in the marriage not working out.
What kind of social life did you have?
Very active social life. Because we were square dancers, folk dancers, interested in lectures, went to almost everything at the symphony and the ballet and the plays and so forth. Had a large number of people who were friends during that time. There were those who were more so than others. We were doing something almost every single night. We had an almost extended family. Our kids, one of the interesting things is that one of my closest friends was also named Richmond, Raymond Richmond. Not a friend, a friend. And our kids were almost a single family that way. He's now retired in Florida. But there was a great deal of that. We were also interested in social movements jointly. For example, we were good friends of K. Leroy Urbis, who is now the Speaker of the House. And he was working for the Urban League, and we went out as two couples to integrate the restaurants in Pittsburgh. People don't realize that the restaurants in Pittsburgh did not serve blacks until late in the 50s. Everybody thinks of that as a creature of the 30s or 40s. One of the reasons Webster Hall got so many union dinners and so forth was that the downtown hotels did not serve blacks. I remember during the 30s when Nat King Cole couldn't get a room downtown and had to stay up on the hill. He just wouldn't be given one. So the union movement would not go to a hotel that did not serve blacks, and Webster Hall was a beneficiary of that. See? But the individual restaurants were different. I remember going into Anthony's or Bullen's, one of the two in East Liberty, with the Urbises, he and his wife, his first wife, she died afterwards, and sitting there for 3 hours while they did not serve us, and other people came in. And finally I went up to the owners and I said, we're going to sit here all night. And if we're not served when we leave, we're going to go out and sue you. So finally we were served. We went to another restaurant and all wound up very sick because it was quite evident that something had been put into the food. And this was in the 50s, believe it or not. This may be shocking, but it was very true. We were interested in the civil rights movement, in fair employment. And interestingly enough, at that time it was not from a base with Jewish organizations. As a matter of fact, I had very confused feelings about Jewish organizations and had many of the stereotypical attitudes of the 30s towards the so-called Balabatim, you know, the Jewish establishment. Almost a sneering disdain, believe it or not, for Rosh Hashanah people. Well, this was because of the old Hill District attitude towards German Jews as feeling they were better. Something I'm ashamed of now, by the way, but that's how I tell them. So that I didn't respect Jews waitress who gave large sums of money to charities because I would sneer and say, what the hell, it's tax deductible anyway. You know, these were, interestingly enough, we get a lot of this sloganeering out of the kids, and I was as susceptible as anybody else, you see. So that I was not associated with either the religious or the non-religious Jewish community to any degree. My friends were heavily Jewish, you see, but not exclusively so. Now, about 15 years ago, I started to become very interested. Somebody suggested me to the Community Relations Committee of UJF, and I just got more and more interested in it. I just went back on the board of Jewish Family and Children's Service. I was on that for 12 years. Part of that was a carryover from my Department of Labor work, because we granted permits to sheltered workshops which were allowed to pay lower wages to mentally or physically handicapped people. And we policed that so that it would be a proportionate wage, not so low as to exploit them, not so high as to make it infeasible. From that, I went on the board of United Mental Health, and I did a lot of placement of the mentally retarded and so forth. It was kind of a side interest. So it was a kind of a gradual movement in the Jewish community. Now it's very heavily Jewish. We won't forget your
No, because we have other times.
Yeah, that's all right. If I do want to insert it now, I'll be looking at it. Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your children now.
All right. Well, Ray, my children, the one daughter, Rachel, the eldest, very much reflects the social thinking of her parents. When she graduated from Chatham, I told her that she'd worked very hard. She should take her graduation presents and just take off and loaf for a while. And that, just to get a picture of the country. And that I would backstop her for a couple of months after she had run out of money. Then she had to get serious. She wound up in Berkeley, which understandably was very attractive to someone who was social-minded and who was in that sloganeering stage that I told you I'd gone through as well. And she said that's where she wanted to live. Well, her now relatively more conservative father said, look, there's 12% unemployment for college grads in Berkeley. I understand why you love it. But I said, do what you want, but I'm going to backstop you for 2 months. But she was so determined that when I kept my promise not to backstop her, she cleaned apartments. Probably made more money then than she's making now. But it wasn't beneath her. And she eventually got a job with the rent control board, and they have a rent control board there. Berkeley hasn't changed too much. And she was with them for many years. She was with them for about 8 years. And then in that capacity, she met her state legislator, who then gave her her current job, which she's had for the last year. She's press secretary. She spends a good deal of her time in Sacramento in the PR for him and so forth. But he is a very social-minded legislator. So there's almost my mother, myself, rerun, and my father, myself. Jessica is basically a social-minded, caring person, but not active at all in that sort of group activities. I don't think she's ever been in a demonstration. Rachel is proud of the fact that she and a group of rabbis were just arrested for an anti-apartheid demonstration. Rachel, interestingly enough, with these slogans and with certain kind of left-wing tendencies, also has a lot of close friends in the more orthodox Jewish community. Kids can reconcile these things. I don't know how I could. She has a Lubavitcher friend and some Hasidic friends and so forth. And yet she likes Marxism at the same time. so that Jessica has concentrated much more on career goals. She has friends, but they are personal. She isn't in any social movements. She is in certain kind of community movements, that is to preserve the character of old neighborhoods, that sort of thing. But this fits in with her job as a city planner. So she went on and got her master's in city planning. So that her outside activities very much relate to the work she does. She worked for the city of Portland, which is a very, very progressive city. I'm very proud from a Jewish perspective that they had the Neuburgers, first the husband and the wife, who were senators from there, and no hesitation in having Jews come in. No hate movements have ever gotten started there, and yet it's a comparatively rural state, very unusual state. So they're quite content. Their father isn't because he's Jewish and they're unmarried, but they're quite content.
Okay. You know, you mentioned that you're a member of Rosh Hashanah now, in spite of whatever resentment or whatever you felt for German Jews.
Stereotypes.
Or what your family upbringing is. How did this come about?
Well, it happened gradually. I had never, every once in a while I would consider joining a synagogue simply because in terms of, I've had an increasing concern about hate, and that included anti-Semitism. Just as I was concerned about anti-black people. Right now, we're having one hell of a time handling the Jewish backlash because of Farrakhan. And I understand it. I had to fight within myself to hold that backlash. So that I'm doing the best I can, but I have a hell of a time arguing with people. And I was very fortunate in that I was never subject to blatant anti-Semitism. I'd hear a snide remark or something. I had work I liked. Right now, when I retire next year from mediation, I have all kinds of work without any relationship to whether I am or I'm not Jewish. It might have been just luck or whatever, or maybe I'm naive. I don't know what they say. But I become very interested in anti-Semitism and joined B'nai B'rith, which I had always disdained joining. I'm interested in the Anti-Defamation group, I'm interested in Hillel, things of that sort. Still more of a cultural overall standpoint than a ritualistic Jewish standpoint, you know what I mean, in terms of prayer and so forth. About 4 years ago, I attended a meeting of the senior men's discussion group at Rosh Hashanah. That, Pauline Hitler, who's now invited me, he was active there. And I started to go. It's every other Thursday morning. And if you're available, you're invited. We have excellent speakers. In time, I became the program chairman. And we have a logistics problem. We have so many people coming. We have 150, 175 people come there. And we've helped set up one at Beth Shaw. See, I find my background makes it much easier to not be that excited about whether someone is Orthodox or Conservative or Reform, because I never got slotted, see. But Rosh Hashanah is down the street from me, and I started to go to the concerts and things of that sort. And after a while, I felt very guilty about the fact that here I was using their facilities and in their activities, and I felt that, not only that, I don't know Hebrew. Now, emotionally, I love to go to a Hebrew service. I don't know what's going on, but I feel very deeply. And my conflict the other way is that Rosh Hashanah, I don't feel deeply, but I know what's going on. Okay? Yeah, this is the on the amalgam of the Hill District, you see. I hope you understand that.
My background is so parallel to yours.
Is that right?
Oh, boy.
Well,
go ahead.
Okay. So I joined this last November, you see. And I occasionally go over to a service on Friday night. I'll be going to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur services. Interestingly enough, even back on the Hill where you had this disdain by the socialists and the communists, they generally went to show what the services on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I know we did. I'd always go. Maybe it's because the little girls were there or whatever it was. But we would go.
It seems as though you, as I see it, may feel that the Jewish people or Jewish religion makes good people, and you want to be part of making good people, whether or not monotheism is involved or not.
Yeah, you're right. I think you've described it. Not only that, one of the things that I have to fight, because I've fought against this quite a long, is almost a Jewish chauvinism. Put it this way, when I go to a board meeting, because I've been on various boards, transitional living services, various halfway houses, and so forth, it may be a prejudice on my part, or a predisposition of the actual thing, but I feel tremendously proud of the kinds of people that I find on boards, and these are the various great people I've seen before, and I sometimes people get things because of what's after the comma after their name, so that I've had some things which superficially are on the record.